content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, Biden declares war on the cult of efficiency by Franklin Foer. This week, the Biden administration very quietly published a manifesto for counter-revolution. It didn't arrive trumpeted with flaming rhetoric. There was no televised speech or Oval Office photo op, just a draft memo from the Justice Department and Federal Trade Commission laying out the new standards they will use to assess the legality of corporate mergers. This is, to say the least, not the most scintillating piece of reading that will be released this year, but it may turn out to be one of the most consequential. The revolution being countered started pretty quietly, too. For most of the New Deal and post-war years, the U.S. government took aggressive stance on mergers. Concentrated economic power was understood to threaten core American values, and even to have helped trigger the Great Depression. The antitrust agencies tended to be suspicious of corporate deals, even when the parties involved were nowhere close to dominating the market. This consensus began to wobble in the 1970s. The arrival of the Reagan era flipped it on its head. In 1982, the administration issued its own merger guidelines, making clear that the days of aggressive antitrust enforcement were over. This was not huge news at the time. Kids today certainly don't read about it in history class, and yet the impact of the policy shift, along with court rulings limiting the scope of antitrust law, has been enormous. In the four decades since, the American economy has grown dangerously concentrated, dominated by a shrinking number of airlines, banks, tech companies, and pharmaceutical firms, to name just a few examples. Corporate titans have amassed outsized influence over the political process, smothered startups, and often treated consumers with shocking indifference. Study any dysfunction in American economic life long enough, runaway health care costs, baby formula shortages, regional inequality, and you're likely to find corporate concentration among the causes. Why did the Reaganites do this? They were enthralled to the idea that the highest, in fact, the only valid goal of economic policy is efficiency, narrowly defined as the maximum output for the lowest prices. And they believed that big business was inherently efficient. They were devastatingly successful at entrenching that view. For two generations, their view of efficiency became the driving logic of competition policy and other areas, including trade, regardless of the party in power. Concerned for how monopoly power might affect workers, small-town businesses, or even democracy itself dropped out of the analysis. The Obama administration's 2010 guidelines, for example, exempted even more mergers from review and praised corporate deals for their potential to generate significant efficiencies and thus enhance the merged firm's ability and incentive to compete. One of the most overlooked features of the Biden administration has been its willingness to challenge the efficiency fetish. The merger guidelines are at its most frontal assault today. In the view of Biden's antitrust officials, Washington's turn toward efficiency, a word that doesn't appear in any antitrust statute, substituted the preferences of libertarian economic professors for the laws that Congress actually passed. The new guidelines seek to undo that. They don't reject economic analysis, but their guiding theory is that corporations ought to be prevented from acquiring the kind of power that enables abuses, even if economic models promise some sort of efficiency gain. If the new standards were applied retrospectively, some of the splashiest mergers of recent memory would probably not have been allowed to happen, at least not without a fight. Think Exxon and Mobil, United and Continental, Amazon and Whole Foods, and so on. Smaller deals could have been challenged too because the new guidelines recognize that a lot of little mergers can add up to monopoly power over time. Facebook might have been denied its purchase of the virtual reality company Oculus. Google might not have been allowed to roll up the digital advertising market. Perhaps the clearest example of the new approach is the guidelines' insistence that the government scrutinize how mergers might hurt workers, not just consumers. This builds on the Justice Department's successful lawsuit to block Penguin Random House from acquiring Simon & Schuster. In that case, the government argued that the deal would have resulted in smaller advances for authors because one fewer publishing firm would be competing for their talents. The effect on writers was more important than whatever supposed efficiencies might have flowed from the consolidation of the industry. In the age of polarization, each political party has learned to exploit the power of the executive branch to the hilt. Unable to use closely divided Congress to achieve their goals, administrations rely on far flimsier powers of fiat. In fact, the Reaganites helped pioneer the tactic of revolution by government memo. They saw their merger guidelines as a way to change the law without any actual legislation. As one concerned observer put it at the time, under the guise of regularizing discretion, the antitrust laws are being amended without benefit of congressional action. The flaw in this approach is obvious enough. Any executive action can be reversed by the next administration. But bureaucratic policies also have the potential to stick, if skillfully conceived. They can manage not just to survive legal challenges, but to become enmeshed in the culture of the civil service. In the case of the merger guidelines, there's the further hope that the populist wing of the Republican Party might embrace the policy out of a shared concern with the power of big tech. The Biden merger guidelines have been built to sustain future attempts at dislodging them. Despite their radical intentions, they pose as an act of modest interpretation of judicial precedent. Every new policy is presented as the faithful expression of existing law, amply footnoted. The implicit argument is that the discipline of antitrust has been eroded from within, captured and distorted by market fundamentalists from the Chicago School of Economics. These guidelines present themselves as merely a revision to the laws as originally conceived and written. Will that gambit work? As the name implies, the guidelines don't have the force of law. Ultimately, the fate of a merger challenge is usually decided by a federal judge. Just last week, the FTC lost its effort to stop Microsoft from closing its $69 billion deal for the video game developer Activision. The federal judge who ruled against the agency is a Biden appointee. Critics will also argue that the new framework is divorced from economic reality and warn that it will result in higher prices. In fact, efficiency-focused antitrust appears to have failed under its own terms. The leading analysis to date finds that mergers have been more likely to raise consumer prices than lower them. But on some level, to focus on price effects is to miss the point. Efficiency was the coldest metric for evaluating a merger. It reduced Americans into the stylized economic caricature known as the consumer, treating cheap goods as our highest and only aspiration. The new guidelines inject a bit of humanity back into the calculus, and they suggest that the ultimate question for government shouldn't be whether something is efficient, but whether it's right. Next, People Just Want to Lose Weight, by Olga Kazan. While exploring the diet app Noom recently, I wasn't sure if I was supposed to be losing weight or healing my inner child. The program encourages you to banish thought distortions, such as labeling foods good or bad. It assures you that slip-ups don't mean failure and nudges you to practice joyful movement. For the first week, all Noom asks you to do is simply believe. And if this psychological approach fails, there's always Ozempic. Noom and the dieting stalwart Weight Watchers have both recently added services that will allow their customers to obtain Ozempic and the other blockbuster new GLP-1 obesity drugs, such as Wegovy and Mounjaro. This spring, Noom launched Noom Med, which pairs it with its behavior change program with prescriptions for various weight loss drugs, the GLP-1s among them. Noom Med will connect its users with doctors who prescribe the drugs. though it won't cover their often gargantuan monthly cost. And Weight Watchers recently acquired Sequence, an online provider of the obesity drugs. People who sign up to get a free Weight Watchers membership will get a Weight Watchers membership thrown in. The move marks the latest reinvention of the diet industry, an acknowledgement that, for some people, joyful movement will never be enough, counting calories is insufficient, and drugs like Ozempic can be a crucial tool in achieving good health. It also reflects the diet world's awkward, enduring reality. Many obese people do want to lose weight, but the desire to be slimmer has become a little gauche. We are supposed to love our body even as we fight like hell to reshape it. To Adrian Bitar, a Cornell historian of the diet industry, this turn shows that although the weight loss world has periodically dabbled in fuzzy concepts like wellness, at the end of the day, most people just really want to lose weight. Why not let them? Americans go on yo-yo diets, but we also have a yo-yo relationship to dieting. For the past century or so, the weight loss industry has bounced between moralizing, shaming, and tepid body positivity, depending on the sentiment of the times. Early eating reformers such as the cracker namesake Sylvester Graham thought that eating better could literally make a person better, more virtuous. Gluttony, Graham and others believed, led to sins like violence and masturbation, as Susan Yeager describes in her book, The 100-Year Diet. Treat your stomach like a well-governed child, Graham advised. During World War I, eating less was considered patriotic, a way of freeing up precious caloric resources for American troops fighting abroad. Later, doctors and psychologists came to the wrong conclusion that overweight people were lazy, and society adjudicated heaviness a disgrace. In the words of Lulu Hunt Peters, an early diet book author, dieting organizations ruthlessly shamed people into losing weight. In the early 50s, one such support group held public weigh-ins and forced members who'd gained weight to stand in a pig line, where they would sing a song that included the lyric, "We are plump little pigs who ate too much, fat, fat, fat." Weight Watchers began in the 1960s when a housewife named Jean Nidetch invited six friends to her house to talk about their weight struggles. Nidetch eventually lost 72 pounds, and she established group support as a pillar of her new program. Still, she remained preoccupied with the weight part of Weight Watchers, urging members to carry photos of their former heavier selves. Yeager quotes her as saying, "I pray that I'll never forget where I came from." But in recent years, dieting has gone the way of the Live Strong bracelet. Magazines stopped using phrases such as bikini body on their covers. Lean Cuisine offered a browser extension that blocked the word diet from web pages. A Dove commercial reminded everyone that size 10 women use soap. It used to be moral to diet. Now it was moral to not diet. Americans are just simply not dieting anymore, a Nestle USA executive told one news outlet in 2016. In 2018, Weight Watchers dropped weight, literally, and rebranded itself as WW. With a new focus on wellness, the company stopped requiring members to have a weight loss goal and cut before and after photos from its ads. Its expanded set of goals for subscribers included, quote, "developing a positive mindset," end quote. At the time, then-CEO Mindy Grossman said, "The world doesn't need another diet, and healthy is the new skinny." Even so, Weight Watchers and other diet programs worked by modifying behavior with the goal, spoken or otherwise, of losing weight. The company now goes by both names. Noom has a strong focus on psychology. The app includes many articles about stress triggers, mindless eating, and behavior chains. "You are not your thoughts, but the observer of your thoughts," the app told me at one point. It also, however, encourages users to weigh in every day, log their food, and stick to a daily calorie goal. And even as it de-emphasized weight, Weight Watchers still offered workout plans and its points system of tracking food's nutritional value. Meetings were renamed workshops, but they still happened. GLP-1s work much better than any of these strategies. They take whatever behavioral modification you're doing and supercharge it. Being aware of the concept of mindless eating is one thing, but with a GLP-1, you won't be as tempted to mindlessly eat. The GLP-1 drug Mounjaro can help people lose 22.5% of their body weight, approaching the amount someone would lose with bariatric surgery, and people overwhelmingly prefer the medications to surgery. With Wegovy, it's 15%, still a life-changing number for the 42% of Americans who are obese. Compare that with diet and exercise, which generally lead to less than 5% weight loss, according to Scott Kahan, the director of the National Center for Weight and Wellness, or 7% if you add in a guided program like Noom. Some people's bodies cling to extra fat. Research has shown that when obese people begin an intense exercise program, their resting metabolic rate declines, making it even harder to lose weight. Obese people have often tried everything, and then these drugs come along, like Go For It Man, Laura Dugas, an associate professor at Loyola University Chicago and an author of that study, told me, you take that help. The advent of these drugs raises the question of whether there's any point for obese people to frantically diet and exercise with no end in sight. The behavioral approach to weight loss has been under pressure for a few years now, says Alex Furman, an analyst at Craig-Hallum Capital Group who covers Weight Watchers. These companies, seeing the upsurge of Ozempic, want a horse in the race themselves. Both Weight Watchers and Noom seem to be acknowledging that diet and exercise alone, the mainstays of their programs in the recent past, just don't work for some people. Executives from the organizations told me they see obesity as a chronic medical condition that sometimes requires ongoing pharmaceutical treatment. Way back in the 60s and 70s, our thinking was people were bad. They ate too much. They don't exercise, they develop obesity, and then everything else goes haywire, Noom's chief medical officer, Linda Anagawa, told me. Now we have learned that actually there are certain individuals who, for example, are genetically predisposed to have insulin resistance. This can lead to abnormal fat storage and a deregulated appetite, which can be helped with the GLP-1s. To Weight Watcher CEO Sima Sistani, the drugs might be a solution for obese people who couldn't lose weight on the program or who kept regaining it. There are people who joined this program and lapsed from our program because it didn't work for them, Sistani told me, and we have to be honest about that. And now we know better. We should do better. To qualify for GLP-1s through either new med or sequence, a person has to be obese with a body mass index higher than 30, or overweight with a qualifying health condition, such as diabetes. Customers are screened by doctors to ensure that they meet the criteria. Sequence costs $99 a month, and new med costs about $120, but neither rate includes the cost of the drugs, which can top $1,000 a month without insurance. To my surprise, weight loss doctors told me that this merging of diet apps and injectable pharmaceuticals could be a good thing. Kahan cautions that the drugs don't work well for many people, but services like Noom Med may help obese people who live in remote areas or can't reach a specialist. We've increased the ranks of obesity medicine doctors, but still the majority of Americans don't have access to one, he said. Done well, these virtual care programs could potentially be extremely valuable. Though medications like Ozempic and Wegovy help people feel fuller and think about food less, the person taking them does have to consume fewer calories in order to lose weight. And that's where a program such as Noom or Weight Watchers can be helpful. Something like the Noom app, which includes quizzes about which foods are healthiest, grapes or raisins? It's grapes. May allow people on GLP-1s to maintain a lower weight in perpetuity. What leads to the most dramatic weight loss is a combination of obesity drugs and healthier habits. And dramatic weight loss is, after all, a goal for many people. At one point, Sistani used the phrase weight health, and I asked her whether healthy is the new skinny was still the company's ethos. I think the word diet and diet culture and where it went wrong was a preoccupation with thinness, Sistani said. She appreciates the concept of body positivity, she told me, But she also seemed clear-eyed about obesity's downsides, that it shortens a person's lifespan, for example, and increases the risk of cancer and other maladies. Within that framework is still the opportunity to talk about well-being and how do I live? How do I achieve longevity? How do I have a strong, healthy life? Your weight is going to be part of that. The yo-yo has snapped back, and we've concluded that dieting people don't want to be moral, patriotic, or shamed. They just want to lose weight. That desire has always been value neutral, but now it's more attainable. Our next article is In Praise of Phone Numbers by Charlie Warzel. Imagine for a moment a technology that is simple and universal and needs no software updates. It is a string of numbers, each portion acting as a precise set of coordinates, so basic and elegant that your great-grandparents could use it. Put the numbers in the correct sequence and the technology immediately triggers a bit of magic. Where seconds ago there was silence and haptic nothingness, all of a sudden there is a glorious burst of sound or vibration, miles, even continents away. Then, if you're lucky, you hear a voice and you respond with yours. Your questions, your frustrated pleas to speak with a representative. The phone number has been with us in some form since 1879, and unlike carbon paper, VHS tapes, and the Walkman, it is not yet obsolete. Although there are dozens of ways to get in touch now, few are as durable and reliable as picking up the phone. A quick thought experiment. Say you just got in a fender bender, or if, God forbid, find yourself in a genuine emergency. Would you text for help, or would you dial an emergency contact, or 911? Although so much of our identities have migrated online, these sequences of numerals are an analog tie to the physical world. When we make an account or need to prove our identity to any given system of machines and networks, we use the string of numbers as a means of authentication. But the phone number isn't just the yeoman farmer of the technological landscape, a modest utilitarian workhorse. It is also a vital cultural touchstone. I am and have always been a man without a country, a person who, because of childhood relocations and general adult restlessness, has had the great fortune to adopt many a hometown, from Manhattan to Missoula, Montana. Despite my wandering, my sense of place and a non-trivial aspect of my identity is forever fixed, thanks to three simple numbers, 610, which is switchboard speak for the Philadelphia suburb zone. I lived there for only a decade, but it was when I happened to get my first cell phone. My area code thus provides me with something akin to a clever disguise or even a passport. I can't help but feel a little romantic about the fact that one day in 2003, I stumbled out of a Hot Topic and into a singular wireless store at the King of Prussia Mall and emerged with a mostly random 10-digit signifier that I still use to log in to my bank, contact the vet, and text upsetting AI-generated TikToks to my group chat at 1 a.m. That's staying power and versatility. After I tweeted about the role phone numbers play in our lives, a number of people responded to share their own perspectives. A phone number can mark a new occasion, as it did for a user named Austin McKinley, who told me that the first thing he did in 2008 when he moved to San Francisco was to buy an iPhone and get a local phone number. Old life over, new life started, he wrote. In places such as Maine and my former Montana, an area code can mean state pride. Having a non-207 number is an immediate signal of outsiderness, Twitter user Ben Sprague, a Mainer, told me. Woe to those who, from away, suffering the slings and arrows of area code discrimination. A good number can also be a sentimental tie to the past, as it is for a user located in Philadelphia who goes by Amy, and who told me that she inherited her number from her mother when she died. And my friend John, who tweets as Johnny Courage, holds on to his 919 area code in order to keep my Carolina bonafides and Southern expat status strong, he wrote. It's a quaint relic of yesterday, sure, but it connects me to home. These old-fashioned pleasures shouldn't suggest that the phone number hasn't evolved over time. As my colleague Megan Garber wrote in 2014, phone numbers started out as a peculiar alphanumeric addresses that served small geographic areas. For instance, MU59975, she wrote, would direct you to a switchboard agent who would then connect you with a line in the Murray Hill neighborhood of New York City. As phones grew more popular, the manual switchboard system became automated, and the number system went from regional to national, with a longer set of numbers and the introduction of area codes. Each time the numbering system is expanded, we've grumbled about it, but still it persists. North America's current 10-digit numbering system launched in Maryland in 1997, and we haven't looked back. But even the 10-digit system, one of technological constraints of my life, has an expiration date. At some point, the numbers will run out, a realization that has caused me to wonder if anyone is keeping tabs on our numbers. Thankfully, the North American Numbering Plan Administrator, the delightfully bureaucratic organization that manages and assigns phone numbers and area codes in 20 countries, is on the case. NANPA's team works with carriers and state commissions to roll out a new area code, a process that takes at least 3 years, Florence Weber, NANPA's senior director, told me. We continue to see an uptick in terms of requests for numbers. That's not going away, Weber said, but nothing lasts forever. NANPA is closely monitoring and preparing for the day that we run out of three-digit area codes or have to move beyond the 10-digit number. Weber told me that, according to NANPA's proprietary prediction system, which takes into account forecasted demands and assignment rates, the projected exhaustion date is sometime in 2051. I shudder to think what will happen on that day. Still, it's worth considering what we lose if our area codes, prefixes, and line numbers are slowly washed away by the sands of time. If nothing more, it's worth appreciating these digits and a personal series of semi-random numbers that, once they're yours, take on a new life. When shared, a phone number is the most intimate of invitations, offering boundless possibilities of connection. It moors and orients us. That alone is a small miracle worth celebrating. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, and have a great day.